Carol Avery is my name, and this is my third talk, I guess, on different aspects of Saudi Arabia. I have to apologize already. I see how much overlapping there is on so many of these topics, and some things I say today, if you came before, you maybe have heard before, and I apologize to those of you. But it's amazing how much comes out about all the different aspects and just talking about the country itself. But today I wanted to focus a little bit on Muslim women, the role of Muslim women. And I didn't put in Saudi Arabia, although that's mostly what I'm going to talk about, because Muslim women in other countries lead quite a different life than in Saudi Arabia. And in Saudi Arabia, they lead probably the strictest life, strictest moral code of any of the Islamic societies. But then, as my husband says, if you see that as the basis of Islam and of the Quran, then maybe that is a good place to look and to start out. So, some basic, first of all, talk on just what it's like for the women living in Saudi Arabia, the Muslim women there. Yesterday I talked about what it's like being a Western woman living in the country. And the problem here is that there have really gotten to be two very different types of women, much as there are in this country, because now there is such an affluent class of people. And they've drawn away from their extended families, and they live on their own, especially at the university where we are. Each family is provided with a house, only enough room for their immediate family. Whereas traditionally, and still quite often, the custom is to live with the husband's family. So the Saudi woman would have quite a household of women to deal with every day, her mother-in-law and her sisters-in-law and all of their children and any other extended family that might come in. So needless to say, they have enormous houses that they live in, many, many rooms. They have to house all these people. Then there are still, not very many, but there are still some of what are called the Bedouin society, the desert people, the nomads, who do live in tents still. Some of them have been given a housing of sorts, a shelter anyway, but they still have their camel herds that they tend, and they still drift around. And of course, their lifestyle is quite different than the lifestyle of the Saudi women that I associate more with. But theirs is a diminishing breed, kind of sadly, I think. Many of them gave up their desert life with reservation, and the government pretty much wanted to settle people in the cities to develop the country. Something just comes to mind is that a couple places close to us, huge housing developments have been built, probably eight-story buildings, one after another, with huge courtyards in between, and they sit completely empty. They were built for the Bedouin to come in, live in the city, and they just said, we don't want to, and nobody would come to live in them. And when we think of the millions of dollars, it's like a ghost town driving around these places. And they just have sat empty for years and years, and probably will forever, because nobody wants to live there. So even though the government has tried, and in many ways succeeded, in urbanizing the people, there are still those that keep to their old ways.
Are they vanishing because the children are deciding they want to move into the city, and so little by little the better ones are diminished?
That's part of it. Another part is that some of them have been just offered wonderful jobs with tremendous amounts of money to come and live in the city and to get involved in the oil industry. And it's tempting, I'm sure. But there still are a substantial number of Bedouins. Quite a number of students my husband gets every year have literally come from the tents into the university. And it's quite an adjustment for them. Yeah. So there are both kinds of backgrounds to consider, and like I said, I'm really only very familiar with the more urban society of the Saudis. There's one town about 80 miles from where we live called Hofuf, which is a fascinating place to go to. It's where a lot of trading takes place, and to go there on the weekends is so much fun. And there you see, in the midst of the rushing traffic coming into town, a lot of donkey carts weaving in and out of the cars, and the people coming in to sell their wares, the things they've made. The women bring in a lot of yarn to sell, camel's hair, goat's hair, and wool. And the men bring in jewelry that they've made, and they make coffee pots, which I'll show in a couple days. So there are both sides, but basically, their way of life is still based on the Quran, all of them. They all have the same sort of restrictions in their life. Their life pretty much is centered around the house, and there's not a whole lot for them outside of the home. Some of them have gone off to school, either in hopes of getting a job, which is not a very realistic hope, or I think more just for something different to do, a way to get out of the house. So I want to give a little bit of background on the Quran and just what it is that the Quran has said about women's role, and since they do base their life on the Quran. I take most of this information from a book called Muslim Women, which was written by a lady by the name of Frida Hussein. And interestingly enough, any books I could find on Muslim women at the university and at the school I teach at said almost nothing about Saudi Arabian women. I don't think the country wants you reading about their own women. So most of that's right, exactly. The things that were written about their women were very glowing reports, of course, that you sort of had to read, take with a grain of salt. One of them went on and on about the wonderful schooling opportunities for women. Then in this other book, it happened to have a chart of the literacy rate, and Saudi Arabian women ranked the lowest at like 3% or something like that. So although the Saudis are constantly wanting to try to impress us with how good everything is, then you hear the other side, and what's frustrating is you never really know the truth. You don't ever really, you can't sit down with an almanac and just read the facts, because you never know for sure. But basically, and I quote, it says, Islam evolved principles and influenced all aspects of social existence. And that's important, that unlike Christianity in our culture, where we have separation of church and state, Islam permeated their whole culture and does till today. Permeates the government, permeates the household, and it's because of that that the women have the role that they do. The proponents of the traditional Islamic way of life want not only to retain but to re-strengthen it through what they call institutionalization. And that basically means that there is a difference in ranking of men and women, and that they believe that the female world or the home should be cushioned off from the male world or public affairs, that should be kept very separate, and the women should be kept there and, as they say, protected. And a lot of the women say that too. They feel protected and they like that feeling. But it's definitely very much of a separation there. Their ways of life are based not only on the Quran, but also on something, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing this right, called the Hadith, H-A-D-I-T-H, which is a book of early Islamic traditions. And that talks a lot about Muhammad and his way of life. And the Muslims like to model their own life after the way he lived and his wives, because they see that as the perfect model. So even though it isn't actually written in their Quran or their holy book, it's still taken very seriously. And if women read that the prophet's wives did these sorts of things, then they feel like for them to do that is to sort of glorify themselves and purify themselves. So the belief is that Muhammad and his companions acted under tacit divine inspiration that elevated their actions to a legally binding precedent or model behaviors. There again, that what he did was divine, and they look to that and want to follow it. So the women in the Quran, one thing that was brought up is that Islam is really a religion of the city, that when it comes to the desert life, there is sort of a natural balance in the division of labor, because the women have to be out of their tents and they have to be involved in helping with the camels and with doing all the work, and then the men are doing much the same. So you don't get quite the division as you get in the urban society. And Islam was more, Evan, a religion of the city. And so it got to be a problem of what do we do with these women? Now they're in the city. They don't need to be outdoors. They don't need to be helping with the camels, finding the food. We'll provide them with the food. And so how do we handle them? How do we keep them in place without starting to run away from the home and try to seek their own way? So, as was mentioned last night, Muslims will say that women benefited greatly from Muhammad and from the Quran. Before the time of Muhammad, the women really did have a very miserable existence. They were completely subjugated to male domination. The men's rights over the women were exactly the same as over any property that he owned. He paid money to the family. In other words, he bought his wife. And the marriage contract then was between the husband and the bride's family, with her as just like a sales object. And he simply purchased her. And so then he figured, I've paid my dues, now she's mine, I can do with her as I wish. And many of the women were treated very harshly. The men at that time, before Muhammad, could have any number of wives and could treat them just as he willed. The divorce then was entirely up to the husband, who could discharge of her simply by paying off his debt to the family. Maybe when they first got married, he couldn't pay the whole amount of money. He made a down payment, in other words. If he wanted to get rid of her, all he had to do was find a way to pay off that debt, and then that was it. He could be rid of her just simply by doing that, much as we would any object, any car or anything else that we buy.
What were some of the reasons for wanting to get rid of her? I mean, if he had chosen her in the first place?
Oh, I can imagine any number of reasons. If he's allowed to have any number of wives, finds a wife who's a little more desirable and yet doesn't have the...
Kind of a whim.
Right, exactly. And it gets expensive when you have wives and more wives, and of course they're all producing children and more children, and I can easily see where he'd just get tired of one and want to discard her very quickly, take on another.
Well,
I know, it's incredible.
Pardon? Do the kids go off with her?
Well, he has the right to keep them once they turn the age of 7. Now, this is pre-Muhammad's time. I'm not sure what the ruling was at that time. Whether or not he'd want to, I don't know. It probably depended on the family itself. But also at that time, women were not allowed to hold any of their own possessions. So it was just simply the woman. And that was it. Anything extra that was she considered hers was really her husband's, and he could do with it as he pleased. So then the Quran came about, Muhammad came about, and it really did improve the social status and the legal rights of women, speaking relatively, of course, to how they were before. Apparently it was not an uncommon custom before the time of Muhammad to bury female babies alive just to get rid of them because they were not worth much at all. After this time of Muhammad, the Quran determines that marriage is a meritorious institution. It makes it a very important bond now, marriage, rather than just something to be taken very lightly for the woman just to be property. It restates it as being a very important, valuable institution and something that should be cared for. And this time, although this is still a little bit hazy, the contract of marriage was more between man and woman than it had been. Although it still is that the parents pretty much will choose a partner for their son or daughter. The children do have more of a say now on whether or not they do want to get married. And that is increasing all the time. And it's not just where they're buying, where they're just paying money and buying an object. It is taken quite seriously. Then the number of wives were restricted to 4 that the husband could have, which doesn't sound to me like any real great advancement, but I suppose that, and I should say 4 at any one time, so he still could get rid of a wife and take on others. But the Quran just made it a much more serious contract to get into marriage, not to be taken quite so lightly. What's interesting, of course, is that the woman is never free to have more than one husband. It's always the other way around. Just as the husband is, according to the Quran, is free to marry whom he chooses, the Quran pretty much specifies it should be somebody of a belief. And in the book I read, in parentheses, it said Christian or Jewish. Should be a believing woman, but doesn't have to be a Muslim woman. Whereas a Muslim woman must marry a Muslim man. She doesn't have any choice. Not that I know how, I don't know how you would ever get, how a non-Islamic man would ever get to meet a Saudi woman. That, however, in other Arab cultures, we know quite a few Western men married to Muslim women, not Saudi women, but Muslim women of other cultures. So I guess it all, again, depends on how strictly they take this religion. Finally, women had the right to inherit property. She would only inherit half of what any males in the family would, but she did inherit that property, and it was hers then to do as she pleased with it. She also acquired jewelry with her family, and when she got married, that was her jewelry and her money to do with it as she wanted. So again, a slight increase in her rights, not great, but the Muslims today like to emphasize that they were much better off with the Quran than they were before. The woman had full control over her wealth. It specifies in the Quran that it's the right of women to be properly fed and clothed at the husband's expense. He's in charge then of taking care of her and treating her well, whereas before that he could, like I said, treat her just as any piece of property. Then the divorce still is not a very difficult thing to do, but there is, according to the Quran, a 3-month waiting period after the husband pronounces twice, "I divorce you, I divorce you." Then there's a 3-month waiting period. If it turns out that the woman should be pregnant, then the husband is strongly advised to take her back. It's not demanded of him. And then if after the waiting period he still wants to release her, then he shall do so in all kindness. So again, it's pretty much the husband that wants to get rid of the wife. But in a subtle way, it's a little bit kinder than it had been. Do you have a question, or are you stretchy, pulling out your yarn? So then, still though, of course, there is no what we would call equality of the sexes. When there comes to any kind of testimony on a crime or such, it would take two women to equal what one man would say. A woman's testimony is worth half of what a man's is. And no, a woman is not free to divorce a man. I'm not sure what she does if she really wants to get rid of him, if she tries to make life miserable enough so he wants to get rid of her. Probably, I think that there'd rarely be a case where a woman would want to divorce the man, because then what would she do? She could only go back to her family. She doesn't have a career she can go and pursue and a job she could find. Right, yeah, I had written right here, women cannot seek divorce. As far as the religion goes, both the men and women are morally responsible to Allah or to God. And the belief is that they're both treated equally in the hereafter, in heaven, that they are equal at that time. So apparently then things kind of reconcile, this equality. And the Muslims like to point out that they are really more just to women than the Christians are, because in the Quran it says that both Adam and Eve are responsible for the fall. Apparently they both went and took a bite of the apple at the same time or something. It's not that Eve was the one who did the initial sin. And they like to point to that and say, see, really, really we are much more equitable towards our women. And so then what comes up, the immediate, the obvious, what you see in the Muslim women in their separation is their clothing and in their having to veil, having to cover, having to wear black, hot nylon in a hot desert country. As I mentioned briefly last night, as far as the Quran goes, it only specifically states that women shall be veiled and clothed in referring to the Prophet Muhammad's wives. And when it comes to speaking of women in general, it's a very general clause that mentions covering with a cloak when in the presence of strangers and displaying their adornment only to their husbands or their immediate male relatives. So it's more been an offshoot of the tradition of Muhammad's wives that started the complete covering up. And Saudi Arabia happened to have gone much more the traditional line, largely because King Abdulaziz, in trying to bring the country together, realized that the only way he could do it was to placate a large group of very, very fundamentalist Islam people and to go along with their ways. And they believed that this is the way it should be done. And so he agreed. And in that way, he got their support. And he was wise. He knew that that was the only way to bring all these factions together to make a unified country. So that's the basic outline of what the Quran has to say, why the women live as they do. Before I go on, do you have any questions or any comments? Okay. So then we come up to women of today, Muslim women of today. And again, I mentioned yesterday the book, At the Drop of the Veil, where an American woman was married to a Saudi in the 40s, probably the first American woman to ever live in the country. And it's a real good insight as to what goes on in a traditional household. And those households do still exist. She just talked about like being in a cloud for such a long time, like in a dream world, not really believing that it was her in this situation. But it stressed the monotony of everyday life, everything being the same with all the women, rarely seeing a man. She would mention how if men would walk by or be in the courtyard, that the women would peek out of the windows at them. And that always frustrated her, and she always said she would never get to that point of peeking out at the windows at them. But yet, after a while, she was very tempted to do the same thing. So she found the routine, the boredom, to be almost too much at times. And that she mentioned days when she'd rebel by just staying in her room and saying, "I'm just not going to go down. I can't take it one more day." And then, of course, as the day wore on, what else could she do but go and join them? So the problem comes, I think, nowadays in the women who are more urbanized, that they don't have this extended family to live with. And it's hard. It must be very hard to be plunked all by yourself in a home with the children, be left there all day, and not even have the interaction of other adults. Those are the women that I see and that I really feel sorry for, because they just have virtually no life outside of their home and providing for their husband.
What happened to the extended family?
Oh, they're still living somewhere else, but in order to take the job, like at the university, job has been offered their husband, then they need to come and live on campus. Some of them choose to still live with the extended family if they're in the vicinity, but they may have come from across country or something. And so what happens, and I only realized a month or so ago that what a problem this was. Many of these families then hire a nanny, which I mentioned before, to help with the household with the children. And these nannies are treated very poorly. Our houses are quite small anyway, and apparently in several cases the nannies are forced to live in what is really a closet, that's their home. They're worked very hard. And apparently a lot of jealousy goes on then between the wife and the nanny. She's very jealous of this other woman being around the house. And there is word that a lot of the nannies become sort of playthings for the husbands, people to abuse. And so that whole realm is, it's such a problem when something has worked well over the years, as long as the tradition was there and the extended family was there, and then the wealth has changed all that. And I think they're not quite sure what to do with it now. It's a whole different situation where a woman is forced to stay all by herself in a home, and rather than to have the camaraderie of the rest of the harem anyway.
I think that might be the seed for, you know, future change for women in the country. And it seems like, you know, you could go so far, push a person so far, and they'll just be done.
That's right. And I would say yes. I wouldn't see it, of course, if it were happening. But I can't imagine that there aren't these women that get together that are just plain fed up with the whole thing. I know that there is one woman who's been rather vocal about this whole nanny situation, and she feels it's a real crime that they have to bring people in, women in from other countries, to help with their own children. And, you know, saying, why can't we help take care of each other's children and help relieve each other of this problem that we're in. But those kind of vocalizations are few and far between. And I'm sure that they're often squelched along the way.
Is it a status thing to have a nanny?
Yeah, I think it largely is a status thing, because the Saudis in general don't like to do the menial work, and they're not used to doing the menial work, especially in the past 50 years, since there's been so much wealth. And they become accustomed to this way of life. And I think that's largely it. They just don't want to be the ones doing the dirty work. And then some of them have very large families and probably do really need that extra help. But I think it's just all kind of stewing there in this little house that they're stuck in with no outlet whatsoever. So then some of the women do go to school, as I've said several times before, with limited job opportunities available. Teaching is probably one of the most common, teaching in a girls' school. There is one Saudi woman on our campus who's the principal of the elementary school on campus, which is a Muslim school. They don't go in for nursing, because some of them do become doctors, but then find that there's little to do with that by the time they finish their schooling. One lady that I know of wanted to study the Quran, wanted to study Islam, and was not allowed to, so she went to study English literature, just pretty much for something to do. Something that we see a lot is there tends to be a real problem with obesity in these women, which I think would be natural when you have no outlet whatsoever out of your house. And a good friend of mine from Utah was there for 2 years, and she really tried to start an exercise program for Saudi women, and it was almost rather comical, I thought, to see these women together, and I thought what she was doing was real good, though, trying to stress anything you can do to get yourself moving. Of course, they're not even free to go and take walks. Sometimes in the evening they do, but they're so limited just to that house that that also gets to be a real problem. The one outlet they do have is other women's gatherings, and it's quite an experience to be in one of these women's gatherings. Our women's group has a dinner every May, kind of an end of the year dinner, where they have hundreds of door prizes, and the women come dressed in their finest clothing, bright red frilly dresses and jewelry everywhere. Just the costumes, I mean, it's almost like being at a ball and seeing these costumes that kind of boggle your mind, the lace and the frill and the huge skirts that go everywhere. And then they like to have music playing, and the talk is nonstop. When you try to carry on a bit of a agenda, a meeting, it's about impossible, because the talk, you cannot. It's worse than being in any classroom of children to try to get them to sit and listen. And I don't blame them. Finally, they get this outlet and make the most of it. And a lot of enthusiasm. They do something that almost sounds like a Indian war whoop, where you like that. And if a name was drawn for a door prize of one of their friends, then they would all come out with this woo, and all through the room. So there's just a lot of enthusiasm. And I see it just as a gushing out of what must be so much that's held in for such a long,
yeah,
such a long period of time, that when they finally do get together, they really let loose.
How often do they get together like that?
Not very often in that large of a setting.
Is that
very seldom.
Restricted?
Yes, to women?
No, I mean to how often they can meet.
Oh, I don't think so. I just don't think there's a lot of opportunity. Our women's group does have a monthly meeting. Not to quite the extent of this huge banquet we have at the end of the year. And
so
a lot of them,
that without being veiled because it's women?
They're veiled until they get into the room.
Right, but in the room,
yes,
they can show off.
Yes, and and then they show it all,
yeah,
off. And in fact, that got to be an issue at this last banquet because one of the men of the hotel kept coming in to try to fix the microphone.
Mm-hmm.
And the women were getting very upset because they were, you know, they were disrobed with their, and then he kept coming in and out. And so we finally had to go and talk to him and, you know, work out the problem.
Did you have a Saudi
man? No, he was, again, I don't know, another Arab man, but not a Saudi. Questions, I guess, I have. Some that I kind of wanted to bring up yesterday, too. Now talking about Muslim women in general, because more of the Muslim women that I'd have to deal with, that I'm friends with, are not Saudi women. Quite a few Egyptian women I've gotten to know. Turkish women I've gotten to know. Much more of the free and open ones who get very frustrated. I think they get more frustrated with Saudi Arabia than we do as Western women, because they are also Muslim and they say it doesn't have to be this way. This is not how Islam is. And I think the Saudis tend to look at them like they should be acting as their wives do. So they feel a lot of tension and a lot of rebellion. And I think they have, like I said, even a harder time.
Do they ever fight Saudi women?
Rarely. Very rarely. There is a real division there, which is, I have an article I should bring that mentions that. The Saudis say that that's one thing that angers them. They can see where Western people come in and not speaking Arabic have a hard time getting to know their people. But when other Muslims come, many of whom do speak Arabic, and still there's the division. But like I said, it's just plain hard to get to know anybody, any of the women, because they are always at home and they rarely make the effort to get out. It's very few that we get to meet. So I mainly wanted to bring up, because I know many of you have experiences in other countries, and with women from other countries here, kind of to help me too, is what kind of things you found helpful in communicating with people that have such, and women in particular, that have such a diverse background from us. I always feel it's such a loss, especially when I'm very restricted in what I can say about my beliefs. And there's so much that I would like to say. One thing that was mentioned this morning in the Bible study was how children can be such a unifying force. And I've certainly found that when you have a young child and you're talking to somebody else with a young child, you don't even have to speak the same language and you can get along because you can constantly be referring to them. And I found that to be very helpful. But that still is kind of a surface knowledge of that person. I think in particular of an Egyptian lady that is my neighbor, who I like very much. She has four little boys under the age of 5. The two smallest are twins. And her 7-year-old boy was killed 2 years ago, hit by a car right on our compound. And I didn't know her at the time. I just heard all this talk about this little boy who was hit and killed. And then they left last year and came back this year and are now our neighbors. So I've gotten to know her. And she's always, always bringing up her son. And the tears just well up in her eyes about it. And I feel it's such a loss to know what to say to her. I sympathize with her as best I can. And I really like her so much. I feel very, very sorry for her. And so she has to live with that on top of everything else, on top of being secluded. So I wanted to see what other people had to say and ways that they have communicated with women. I don't know if you've known any women that have been so very different from you. But if you have, I'd like to hear it. Or any ideas of how you think, what kind of bonds could be made with women. It frustrates me sometimes that I feel like I make so little progress with getting to know people, getting to advance. Mm-hmm.
With Muslim women, they allowed to go into someone else's home if you would like to invite co-workers or if you would like to come in.
Yes, as long as my husband wasn't there. I've never had a Saudi woman in my home. But I was almost a little bit embarrassed at Christmas time. My mother works at a Scandinavian gift shop and has sent us a lot of decorations. So we plaster our house with all of them. we had a baby group get together at our house. It was actually a baby shower right before Christmas. And there were probably three Muslim women in the group, and I felt, I don't know, at first I felt kind of funny, and then I thought, well, this is our home, you know, I'm not going to try to hide what I believe, and they didn't seem at all fazed about it, you know, they came in and sat and watched the little twinkly lights, and yeah, really, just kind of curious, but again, it's always kind of the surface, hard to get down below that.
Do most of the women, Muslim women, speak Arabic, or do they also speak English?
Most of them do speak English, mm-hmm. where we are. It's just become such a natural part of, you know, everyday life.
Mm-hmm.
Because they have so many workers who come in from other countries to do to be grocery clerks, to be all, just about every, you know, in the restaurants, the waiters, the way that you see.
Mm-hmm.
And they come mostly speaking English.
Have you had a chance to study Arabic at all?
Only, no, not to any extent at all. That's one thing I feel very badly about, is it hasn't been an opportunity. And largely because it's not something that we can use very much where we are. We rarely hear Arabic. My husband hears it more than I do.
Mm-hmm.
I hear it virtually never. Because it's never Saudi that you deal with when you go shopping. Almost mm-hmm. never. And so English is just the way, you know, what's spoken. And that's a real barrier for me, and it's my fault. I'm not proud of that at all. I feel badly that if I knew Arabic, maybe then it would help.
There's something about language that brings with it the whole mentality and philosophy of a country, and you know, people laugh. I know I was in Germany, I was learning German, and
uh-huh.
at the end of the year, one of my friends had said, you know, I said something, and they corrected me, and they said, we should really make a book of all your golden sayings. I thought, am I saying these things wrong all this year and you haven't corrected me? And I was rather offended, but part of it is just, you know, the effort to do it also communicates another sense of crossing over. And
exactly.
Arabic is a hard language.
Yes, it is. I know any effort I've made whatsoever, you know, in just greeting such in Arabic,
I mean, even that
it's greeted so, you know, they just think that's wonderful, which I think you find in
letting people open up when that kind of barrier is broken in a way that they think they can't otherwise, whether it's true or not, they just think they can't.
That's right.
They won't understand.
Also, you know, it's often hard to communicate in a second language as eloquently or as easily as you can in the first language.
Exactly.
So it might be that they, although they might want to get to know you, don't have the tools of the language to get that deep.
Mm-hmm. That's right. I think that's a part. I see that with my Egyptian friend, although her English is really very good.
Yeah.
And they lived in Washington, D.C. for a year. She gets to a point, and I remember when I lived in Denmark getting to that same point, being so frustrated where there was just so much I wanted to say, and I just didn't have the words to say it. And that is a real problem.
Do Saudi women have any exposure what life is like for women in the West? Do they know?
Well, they do have quite a bit of exposure because of us living there. A lot of them have been overseas with their husbands. When it used to be that many, many Saudi men, young men, went to England and to America to study English. but it's turned around now where the government saw what was happening to their young men. A lot of them were becoming corrupted and exposed to alcohol and the other evils of life. And so now, for the most part, they bring the English teachers to them, which is exactly what we're doing there. Is now they've started their own English language institutes at the university to bring us over to them.
Mm-hmm. You talked the other day about they're having television sets.
Uh-huh.
Would they be able to see on that?
We get one good one good English station, which is broadcast from the oil company, from Aramco.
So that any of them
can can see that. It's very censored, and we get so frustrated when they'll show a real good movie and it gets so chopped up that you don't even know what's happening. You know, you'll see a man and a woman walking together and then you'll be at a completely different scene. So there's never...
Exactly.
There's no touching between them, or you'll see them just coming together and then you jump again. And words are cut out. Oh, even on Sesame Street, silly little words. They'll cut out things about pigs and they'll cut out just silly things. It's to such an extreme. But then we do get TV from Dubai, from the United Arab Emirates, and some of the other outlying countries, from Qatar. And they're not so censored. And some of them have quite good programs, a lot of BBC productions, which we like to watch. So they are exposed in that way. And there are a couple Arabic stations, too, that they see.
Are most of the families sort of in single class, or are there four women and then, what class are they usually?
Well, that's the unusual thing, is that you just don't really see a poor class, if you consider the desert people as being they've chosen now to continue living that way. Mm-hmm. But it's not like they're starving people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they've just chosen that way of life to live. But no, everybody's had money. And that's getting to be a problem now, that money is becoming not so plentiful with the oil prices dropping. And I wouldn't doubt if in the next 10 years or so there was even a real rebellion against the royal family, because people have been led to have such high expectations. So much money, too much money has been available and lavished on especially the young people today. And they don't really know what it is to work, and they don't really want to think that they have to work to really earn a living.
Mm-hmm. But just the old people, like the grandparents, they would have memories of a poorer time.
Right.
Yeah.
Then again, it isn't poor I would think of as poor, as being, people living in the slums and starving, having no job. I mean, their way of poor was to live in the desert, and have their whole lifestyle in that way. It's not like they have a lot of money, but it's not like they're suffering either.
Yeah.
And I think any of them have the choice nowadays to choose the other way of life. The government isn't constantly encouraging them to move into the city.
Sort of like we distinguish between living in poverty and living a simplified lifestyle.
Exactly.
Which,
yes.
One is by choice.
That's right.
By, what's been done to you.
Yes. People who've chosen to build a cabin and have no running water or electricity, we don't look at them as being poor really. Maybe strange, but
right.
Poor. Pardon? The desert people? How do they make a living? They just tend their camels, basically. They may grow a few, have a small garden, if they can, depending on where they are. The soil, actually, if you can get water to it, you can grow quite a few things in it. But mainly they have their camels and their goats and their sheep. And they have the camel's milk, and they have the wool, and they spin the wool. And they basically live, and dates. There are date palms everywhere. And that alone, dates and camel's milk, has for centuries been the subsistence of the desert people. That's what they live on. So,
mm-hmm. All the women in the city can't do anything outside the home. What do they do in the home? Do they have hobbies and industries of their own? Or?
Yeah, they do. They love to collect jewelry, and they do. Quite a few women do weaving. and sewing in the home. And they may read. They play a lot of games, just fun little games like we would play, you know, card games and such. Mm-hmm. Just things to while away the hours, basically. I think now, excuse me, now that there is television, that gets to be a real common form of entertainment, although television doesn't come on until 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4:30 actually, is when the first program starts. So I guess for the rest of the day they have to, I think they mainly do the housework in the morning, have their lunch, and then rest in it for a while in the afternoon. And then their life is really the most active in the evening, more nightlife people.
Who does their shopping?
Their husbands do the shopping. They rarely do any grocery shopping. Unless they live close to a little market they might walk to. But usually in the grocery stores, it's the men you see that are doing the shopping. Because, of course, the men have the cars. The women can't drive. So it's awkward.
Do they plan meals, organize the whole?
Yeah, a lot of the families would have a cook to do that. But you're right. They do plan and they do organize.
So they
send him off with the grocery list, what to buy. Yeah. So, I shouldn't say they never get out, but it's not very easy for them to do so. And just simply being dressed in that terribly hot costume to be out much of the year, I think would be just unbearable. So they, if they do get out, it has to be in the evening or in the cooler part of the year. At the beach, if there's a Saudi woman, she's actually, if she goes in the water, it's with her abaya on, kind of floating in the water with this massive black material floating around. So it's, her opportunity is just so limited.
Wait, when you go to the beach, would you wear just your own swimsuit, like you ran here, and then if you are, how do you react, how do they react to you, and
Well, our university has a private beach, which is where we go nearly every weekend. And there, yes, you do just wear a one-piece swimsuit. And nothing, you know, nobody ever seems to mind. There was one time, however, we went to a public beach. And it was very secluded when we got there. And we were with two or three other couples. So my good friend and I decided we were going to go swimming. And we walked and walked. The Gulf goes on, and it's very, very shallow for a long time. So you walk way out before you can actually swim. And so we were walking and walking and walking. And finally we started swimming, and we turned around. And I could see John at the shoreline waving to me to come in. And I couldn't figure out what was going on. And then I noticed a lot of cars and trucks that I hadn't seen before. Well, as we came in, it turned out there was this whole semicircle of trucks of men sitting watching us out there in the water. And John was livid with anger about it. I said, well, I'd never been looked at in my swimming suit before. I didn't know it was that bad.
But livid with anger at whom?
At the men. I mean,
oh, okay.
He was furious with them.
He was not Saudi-like in his anger towards you.
Oh, no, not towards me. It was towards them, and he was furious. And that's the one and only time we've gone to a public beach. Not only was it that problem, but it was just littered with broken glass and cans, and it was a real mess. So we find our own beach to be quite a haven, a refuge to get away to. We get there just as often as we can.
And that's more wonderful place.
Right. They do have kind of tables with little shelters over them. And they have two separate ones, which I think are basically supposed to be for Saudis and for Westerners. But then we all end up swimming pretty much together. So you just don't see that many Saudis there is what happens. I've never felt funny about that. But those outlets become a real necessity when you've been there, especially by the end of the year. And that's what we found hard in May, was because it was the month of Ramadan that everything was closed down. The beach was closed. The stores were all closed during the day. Nothing opened until 8:30 or 9 at night. Well, by that time, our kids are in bed. And I found that to be very oppressive and too hot to even get out and take a walk around. So that I found very difficult. Let's see, I had a couple other questions written down, but not much time to get into them. this is maybe a little bit off the subject, but if any of you have any input, I'm always curious as to what aspects of our Western culture that you feel proud of, that you feel like you like other people to see, and then what parts you kind of maybe despise is a little bit harsh of a word, but when I'm shopping in town sometimes, there are quite a few American women who live at Aramco, at the oil company. Aramco is just an incredible place. To drive through there is like just driving through Southern California. It's a very secluded area. It's set up to be very, very American. And many people never leave never leave Aramco itself. They have a commissary there. They have everything they need, so they never even have to get to town. I met a woman in town once who had been at Aramco for 7 years, and this was her first time into town. And then, when they are in town, sometimes they are, it's so embarrassing. I just want to crawl in a corner to hear how vocal they are about, and demeaning towards the people, about, you know, how inefficient things are, or how kind of dirty things are, or what are these people going to do without us when we leave, kind of thing. And blurting it right out there in the open. And there are those times when I just feel so ashamed to be an American that I kind of hide in the corner and hope that nobody sees me or something. Do you have any ideas when it comes to meeting people of other cultures? What it is that you're
this might
proud
not
of
be the
it?
Same thing uh-huh. when it comes to mine. I'm from Minnesota, mm-hmm. the south central part of Minnesota, Great Strait, south of Minneapolis, St. Paul. And I teach kindergarten, and we had an interesting experience happen in our school. We had two Indian families from India come to live in Waseco. I think it has a company that's called E.F. Johnson, which is an electronic two-way radios and kind of getting into that kind of things. And there were two brothers that came. And both the brothers have families, and one family went into the, and both had kindergarten children. One went across the hall, and the other, and I got a little girl in my room. And a beautiful little girl with the dark hair and the dark eyes, and very nice, but they were very, very shy because they were having a hard time with language.
Mm-hmm.
And this whole business of going to school with all these kids was different because they had gone to school someplace that had like 10 and 12. It's kind of a private school in their community, and I'm not sure what their town was, but anyway, it was interesting because the mother, she had such a hard time trying to talk with me and trying to make herself understood, and was having such a hard time that she was so embarrassed by this that she would just get real tearful and she would just shake her lip. And I would try my best, and that language barrier is phenomenal.
I know.
Working with that. But here's this little girl, and she's doing the best she can, and her name was Artie. And of course, when her mother pronounced it, it was just beautiful, but I found it funny when I say it. But she smelled, not from a body odor so much as what I finally figured out, I thought it was a cooking odor, something that they used in their home. Because after her mother would bring her, or her father, I could smell it on them. And her father was a handsomely dressed, three-piece business suit. I mean, very, very, they were, you know, engineers in this company. And that the little girl was going home and saying that the kids didn't want to sit by her because she smelled. Well, the mother got the idea that she smelled because maybe it was because she wet the bed.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, I'm not kidding you, we worked really, really hard. But after that, and right before Halloween, they went back to India, and Artie didn't come back to my class until January 11th. And when she came back, she brought me a beautiful hand-carved ivory necklace and ivory earrings.
Oh,
and I said,
nice.
Oh, I said, this is just beautiful. Well, then she said, thank you for being her teacher. And the mother had a note that was accompanied by it. And she had a lady in India help her write it so that she could express her thoughts. And it was to say thank you to me. And this was an adult talking to an adult, not so much for being her daughter's teacher, but because I had been so patient and I had kept crying. You know, and I kept saying, I just think it's an odor that lingers in her hair. Her hair was extremely thick
mm-hmm.
hair. And then she tried shampoos and that. But she was thanking me for keep trying the way we did. We finally got it. She just shampooed her daughter's hair every day. It was a real simple thing.
Right.
But for them, I was just amazed and how difficult it must be for them.
Yes.
Because we take so many things for granted.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's wonderful. I know, again, I say how much children become a good link in communication.
Yes.
And interaction. I'm so grateful for that. I think it helps me a lot in getting to know other people.
I know that's an experience you were saying. There was a long time that I tried to hide the fact that I was American.
Mm-hmm.
And I was good enough at the language, and I was in places where I wasn't so obviously different to do that. And I used to feel really flattered when people were shocked that I was American.
Right.
You don't talk like one. You don't act like one. But no, I don't. But somewhere along the way, I had to own up to who I was. And it was a long process of my own identity, realizing that I began to say things differently. People say, oh, you don't seem like an American. I patiently say, but I am an American. And many of those who you see as Americans, the ones that really stand out, are not all Americans. You know. And let this serve to remind you that there may be some that are different. And usually I establish some kind of relationship to be able to talk about those differences openly and say, I too have been just as you are by what my people from mm-hmm. my country say and do, and I need you to know that we don't all feel that way, we
right.
don't all act that way, that I very much respect who you are.
You can't
wipe out the errors of
exactly.
history or of some really obnoxious people, of which there are many cultures, but you can honestly acknowledge with humility the fact that we all have people we just assume not acknowledge, and that's life.
Right, and I think when you live overseas, you can sometimes understand why so many people overseas have such an awful view of Americans.
Well, they wrote a book 20 years ago, The Ugly American.
Ugly American, I know.
I can't remember the book, but I sure remember the title.
I know.
But this is what it's about.
I know what it means.
But I think that's part of it. You know, one way to avoid it is just to escape your identity.
That's
another
right.
way is to say that, no, it's not bad to be an American, but just because they're that way doesn't mean that I also am.
That's right. And that's what frustrates me, not getting to know people, more people personally. Is it then? I think you can get beyond that.
You can.
Have you ever gotten to the point where you confronted someone, you know, in public and said, why are you so rude to that man who's doing this?
I know, I should. I'm not assertive enough.
Mm-hmm. I've seen that happen. I've seen somebody do that not long ago. I can't remember where right now, but a woman just stopped what she was doing. Somebody was talking to a shopkeeper very disrespectfully
uh-huh.
and said, I think you're being very rude and should apologize. And I don't think they did, as I recall. But still, you know, I was shocked, too. You never think of intervening a lot.
No, you're right. I always try to get out of there.
You're a real activist. Or later on, you go home and think, oh, I should have done sensitizing.
Boy, yeah, it is. I mean, we tend a lot of times to make fun of some of the English that the Arabs come out with. Sometimes they have very humorous signs outside of their shops, that, you know, with words misspelled terribly and everything. And yet, when I try to think if it were me, that was trying to do all these things in Arabic and writing, having a sign outside my shop written in Arabic, I can't even imagine how atrocious it would come out to be. So, but I think that's a good point. To try to get beyond that, you know, just being a Western woman and you being a Muslim woman, and trying to just get to the personal level. Make some contacts that way, I think, is the way to bridge so many barriers. Unfortunately, it's harder for me to do than it is for a lot of others.